Bonjour.
Hello.
Oui, oui. Yes. How are you, Julian?
Good, and you?
It's been a decade or so. Pretty well.
Well, I don't know. Just with my phone.
Oh, man, you got a broken wing, it looks like.
Oh, yeah. Try to set up something here. Is that good? That's pretty good.
You don't need to do anything. You just stand. Or sit. What did you do to yourself?
You're not going to cut my hip.
Is he talking or what's going on?
He is talking, but we're not hearing.
Yeah, I fell on the slab and I fell down.
You fell on a slab?
On a rock.
Oh. Are you broken?
Yeah, dislocated.
It's not really broken. You put it back in then, right?
The doctor did.
Good job, doc. So, Julian, I'm going to explain it out loud because I just said let's talk. Like, pretty much it's Phil and I, we always talk skiing. And we doing our stuff. He's making a cartoon. I'm working on a pet company. And, you know, like, we talk about our stuff, but then every time we talk about ski stuff. So, like, whether it's history, whether it's about what he's up to and all this stuff. And we got into conversations, like, why does a pro skier matter anymore? Then we got into conversations, like, here's some reasons why. And I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, let's just talk to the awesome guys that made a difference. And so you're the first person that we're sitting down and talking with. But the reason why we want to do you first is because I think you're one of the biggest foundation members of, like, Twin Tip Modern Freestyle, Twin Tip Skiing, just everything that anyone who's probably even watching this, the 80 people that love the sport, you're a big reason. Like, from the whole transition and foundation, like, I just want to spend the time to, like, make sure people know about these people and also just make sure you know how dope you are, you know, because you are. And if we can tell it, because who's going to write it nowadays? Who's going to talk about it? Who's going to make a video about it? And if Bill can use his platform on Casablunt on Instagram, so we can tell the people that love twin tip skiing and jibbing, like, hey, here's a big reason why Phil even existed. It's fucking wicked. So pretty much in a nutshell, we just want to talk awesome stories about why you're rad and big you up. So thanks for being here, Julian.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks, Phil, for having me. We always cross each other and I say hi. We never really talked, but I remember you as a kid when you were on the RH team and with JP period. And thanks for having me. Happy to answer some questions if you have some.
Yes, no. Of course we do. Oh. And pleasure to get you on. And now we're going to change that fact that we never talked before so much, but our mutual bond was JP. Rest in peace. But I'm honored to have you. Like Iberg said, we need people to care about the history and what built this sport, and you're amongst the foundational pillars. So we really wanted to get you on, and you're the first guest with our special guest, special Chris Turpin here to perhaps.
Good to see you, Julian. It's been a hot minute for sure.
Yeah.
So, tell us, if I am correct, your grandma, Julian, was in the Olympics for perhaps ski racing. And I wanted to know, like, how influential your grandmother was for your skiing career and path.
Well, my whole family was into skiing. Like, my grandmother was, I believe, in the German in Garmisch 1936 Olympics, and she was always proud because she was Swedish, and it was one of the two nations that didn't do the Hitler sign at the Olympics. So she I don't know which position she got, but she was a Swedish skier. She moved to France because of the mountains. She loved the mountains and skiing. And my mother was very good as well. She was world champ in slalom and silver medal in giant slalom. She had a twin sister which won the globe in slalom, and my cousin, they were pretty good as well, and grandfather was good as well. Anyway, the whole family is just a lot about skiing. So of course, growing up in the mountain, I just wanted to ski, and I didn't want it to be an engineer or anything like. Yeah, I just wanted to ski. I knew skiing was going to be my future.
How many siblings do you have, Julian?
Siblings is brother and sister, right?
Yeah.
I have one brother and one sister, little sister.
Is your brother older?
2 years older, and he was also competing in moguls. And funny fact that we both end up 11 at the Olympics, 2 years apart.
So he went in 2002 and you went in 98, right?
Yeah.
So was that, that's why I asked if he is older, because I knew he went to the Olympics, but I was curious, in that phase, like when, so whatever, you became big, we're the same age, so I'm guessing you started becoming the shit when you're around like 15, 16 or something?
Yeah, maybe 18, more 18, like...
Weren't you 18 or 19 at the Olympics? Weren't you just turned 19 when you went to the Olympics?
Yeah. I was 18 at the Olympics.
So you beat him to the Olympics in the same sport, huh? Your big brother?
That year, yes, I was better than my big brother.
Was that a big deal growing up to try be better than him? Or were you, was there a point where you weren't better, or were you always better? Or are you better?
No.
Just got lucky.
No, I think, but Cedric is less, okay, I can turn it. It was more about working, and I was, maybe I had more raw talent.
Okay.
So it went a little faster for me. But Cedric had a lot of, he's a working horse. So, so yeah, it took a little more time, and you know how it is with the Olympic season. The French team was pretty good. So it was not easy to earn spots, and I was skiing well, and I was lucky to end up second at the Mont Tremblant World Cup. So so then I got in the selection.
So I'm gonna super fan out on the mid '90s with you at freestyle. What was your first year of like mogul World Cup moguls?
My first year was 1998. Same year as the Olympic.
Oh, yeah? So you never did a World Cup before your Olympic year?
But I did. Yeah. No, no. I was straight of Europa Cup and then World Cup. And I had Tien, La Plaine, Mont Tremblant, and that was it. Three World
what
Cup.
What a short, quick
I don't think I've ever heard that story of anyone going there. I think maybe. No. I don't even think Shannon Barkey. No. I don't know anyone, man. That's awesome. Fuck, that's as big as anything right there. So did you ever get to compete against Edgar?
No, Edgar stopped in 95, I think.
And then what was correct me if I'm wrong, the Solomon guy, Bertrand? He was is that his last name? The big mogul skier from the French team in the 90s?
Bruno Bertrand?
He was in the Olympics, right? In like 92 or something?
Well, Edgar, Olivier Alamand.
No, Bruno.
Bruno Bertrand was, I don't think he was in the Olympics.
Okay.
He was in the elite team, but I don't think he went to the Olympics. No, I don't think so.
So let's say 97, like, you don't do NORAMs either, right? You're just doing Europa Cups or something?
Yeah.
So at this time, like, I mean, in the NORAM world, like, there was kind of a crew of doing tricks, right? Because this was state of mind year. You know, Johnny's, like, first kind of thing movie. Who was your crew at this time? Like, were you doing tricks in, like, the 97, 98 season? Like, I know you did a 360 mute in the Olympics, but were you doing – and what was awesome, just a tangent quick, like, in that paddy thing, when you were explaining the poles in one hand and then grabbing the tail and the backflip, I loved it. Mm-hmm. Because you remember Candide had the ripstick poster holding both hands doing the side flip?
No, I don't remember.
So, like, yeah, no, I guess it was a French thing. You guys held both poles in one hand.
No, yeah, never... both poles in one hand. It was David Bouvier. And David Bouvier was big. He was one of the guys that really pushed the style and really pushed the new school thing at that time. And he put both poles in one hand. Which enables him to grab and feel the grab better. And it looks a little quirky now, but anyway, it was a thing. And me, 97, what was I doing? I was doing, probably maybe in 96, I was doing those big backflip tail grabs.
Okay.
I don't remember the dates that much, but... I know that in 97, the French crew was Candide, David Bouvier, and then that was the main ones. They were pushing the style and trying to do things differently. The influence was snowboarding anyway and skateboarding.
So did you guys watch these, like, say, State of Mind? Did you know about it, or did it even get over to Europe at that time?
State of Mind, no.
Okay, because I didn't see it either. Degenerates was the first one I saw. But at the same time, like, coming from Minnesota, like, freestyle was so small, right? Mm-hmm. So we knew, like, Tanner at 13 was doing 720s in the moguls because he had a big red hat on. Or I heard that Vinny had, like, super long skis and he would, like, pop certain ways to camber and transition. Or then, like, I heard about JF doing a Rodeo 7 and, like, at a pro event in a moguls, right? At Sunday River. So it was so fun, like, to not be part of a scene, but, like, to hear about it because the community was so small. So it was just interesting because I never talked to anyone in Europe, like, how it evolved. I didn't even know David was really an athlete because I only saw him really as the team manager of Rossignol. Right? Mm-hmm. When I got to meet him for the...
It was... 97 was the year of the first Ritz-Gonson, I think. Yeah. And... No, 98. No, 98, I think. Because it was after the Olympic. I think so.
That makes sense, because Simo wasn't around before then. And I think he went to that.
And it was kind of... That was kind of a big thing. Like, everybody gathered in... In Ritz-Gonson, me, I couldn't go because I had to go to school. But it was kind of a big start from, I don't know, like the European and the Canadian guys are all together. And it was a snowboard as well. Badly shaped half pipe, pretty good quarter pipes. And it was something. Me, I went to a big air right before in Ore. There was a Red Bull big air.
Yeah.
Was a few athletes doing it, and I won doing a 1080. That was kind of a big thing because it was one of the first big air.
And was this the summer right after the Olympics or same year?
That was the spring,
okay.
Right after it. It was the summer prior the. I don't know. It's degenerate, huh? That year.
Yeah, that came out fall '98.
Yeah. So that was just before. Things were starting to get, like we felt the energy. Of a change, and it was really exciting.
How did you make the call to quit moguls? Because now that you explain, you're third generation Olympic athlete, your brother's an athlete, and now all of a sudden you want to be an artist in a sport. Like, how do you, like, all of a sudden quit after the Olympics when you almost got to the pinnacle of what you were working for?
It was a struggle between what the French Federation wanted me to do and what I wanted to do. Like, I knew, like, I was really good at mogul skiing. I knew I could do good stuff in there. The French Federation wouldn't allow me to do the new generation thing and mogul skiing at the same time. And it was a
fight. And what do they say when you say you're signing up for the World Cup season next year? They say you are not allowed to do activities outside of your activity if you're on this team?
Well, pretty much. Like, the summer 98, I went, like, we had a break in August. Like, we could go on vacation, and I went to Mont Hood and Whistler for coaching and filming.
And is this your Mikey Hilb segment when you're in the church and you lost your 720?
Yeah.
All right.
This is it. And when I came back, I was jet lagged for one of the training camp. I was a little bit tired. And it was my first time traveling, and like I was just jet lagged, and I asked for having 2 days of rest. Just to be back on track. And but I don't know what they thought, maybe that I party for months in North America when I was just skiing. And we got into a fight, like just not a physical fight, but just a fight about...
Can I ask a question? How do they think you party if you don't drink or smoke? Like, do you just go crazy off coffee?
But I guess. But anyway, they thought... I was just not fit and not in shape for the training camp, and I was just a little bit tired from the traveling, and I was just waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I was just like I was just asking for a day of rest, and they wouldn't give it to me, and we got into a fight, and then I quit the training camp. Because I think they asked me to choose between the day of rest and going home, between not resting and going home, and I was like, I'll just go home. I took a bus back to the airport, bought a plane ticket, and went home. And it started to be messy. And then that year, I was kind of training a little bit alone, and just it was just a little bit messy in the between the coaches, but I was skiing really good, we always have a little competition between the team at the beginning of the year, and I did I think I ended fourth on that little competition, so I was still on the top athlete on the team, and. I ended up fourth, but I still remember I was doing quad and 720s, which the other were not doing. And Cusson actually saw my runs, and he watched the competition. And he told me, like, well, it was the best performance that I saw all day. And I knew they just didn't want me to be the best performer the whole day, and it was just like the coaches were judging the athletes and stuff like that. But anyway, but I was skiing really strong. Like that was the point. I was skiing really strong, and I knew I had problem. I was kind of weak at duels, because I just didn't like that dual type of competition. Yeah. It was really not my focus, because it was not at the Olympic, and because I knew I still had to work on my dual game, because I was not good.
Well, it's two different skiers too, right? Look at Garth Hager at that time. Like, Garth Hager wasn't going to win a singles event, but if you went against Garth in a duel in 98, it might have been kind of tough.
Well, exactly. It's two different things. I think I was just too young for the dual mind, and I wanted to have that perfect run and be, you know, be alone in the gates. And anyway, I told my staff that like the dual was not my priority. and to be selected on the rest of the tour, which was a North American tour. I had only one chance, I think, and it was one World Cup. And anyway, like long story short, it was, I think I did my best run ever in the Moguls, and I ended up 18 because I did a 720 court cross, and the judges like score me super low because they wouldn't understand, like basically
it's breaking form.
Yeah, exactly. For them, you had to do a 720 across in the middle and blah, blah. And I just thought it was just not the good style.
Can I ask you
you got to hit your neutrals.
Can I ask you a question about that that's when you were in Mount Hood and you went up to Whistler? Because I know back then, freestyle skiers, we were so few and far between. So as long as you saw another set of twin tips in a lineup, you're like, oh, that guy's probably cool. So when you came over to Whistler for the summer camp, what was your experience of the sport then? Because that would have been like the most congested spot where the most freestyle skiers would have been at the time.
No, were you there in summer of 98?
I think so. I think I was there.
Okay.
I think we had a little competition. It was, maybe it was next summer.
Summer 99, because I filmed it and you did. Yeah, I remember it because I was there as well at the High North Open that had an X Games spot.
Yeah, that was the X qualifier.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember if I was there in 98, but anyway, it was certainly cool to see a lot of action on the camp. It was a lot of moguls at that time as well. I think High North was the only camp without moguls. Yeah, it was cool. It was, but we already knew each other, you know, like it was the same people pretty much, like JP, Dorian, Cusson, and then I learned to meet you. I don't know which year was it, but you know, we always had new people, but it was Shane, Douglas, and the core group was there, so. We knew what we were there for, and we it was a bunch of new people, but I mean the core people, I knew that I was going to meet there and ski with them.
Yeah, I remember and, back then, the only way you ever watched people's progression was either magazines or videos, and then when the glacier came, it was like this epic hub where everyone was vibrating, so like we could all share ideas, watch other people ski, and it was like the first time that I'd actually been able to like interact one-on-one with other skiers and like kind of crack the code about what some of the things that were possible.
Yeah, for sure. And Filou as well.
Oh yes,
Filou,
I see him on here calling you a party pooper
for sure.
So, Julian, I want you to get back. So you were just about to say you were about to quit because I want to know how you get paid as a twin tip right away when, like, you know, did you even get it? Yeah, finish your quitting story because then I have a question how you got paid and get paid.
Well, anyway, at that World Cup, I end up 18 and they only take 16 in the final, so I'm not in the final. And I was like really frustrated because for me it was one of my best run in my life, and I went and saw the judges to ask them why I got so poorly judged on my jump, and I got yelled at from my head coach Eric.
Did you get a yellow card?
Kind of, but I love Eric. He probably doesn't know about that, but I have a lot of respect for him. He's the first world champ in Mogul.
Who is this?
But Eric Berton was my coach. He's the coach that pretty much ended my career in Mogul skiing because we didn't get along. But I have a lot of respect for him regardless. But it always felt strange that he was so strict and that he didn't understand my way of working. And he wanted to fit me into something, into a team, into something else that I didn't need. Yeah. And therefore I left. So I didn't get selected for the rest of the tour, and I was, of course, I was skiing strong, and I could have won World Cup that year. So big frustration, and then I went to Quebec, ski. The year before that, I broke my collarbone 2 times. So it was a blank season for me. And
the year before the Olympics.
Yeah. No, okay. After the Olympics.
Right, okay.
After the Olympics. So kind of a blank season. Collarbone broke 2 times in a row. So the year that I'm talking about is the year of my comeback. So come back from a long injury, being fourth in the pre-qualification, on the team, skiing strong, but still not being qualified for the rest of the World Cup just because of basically politics. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to go ski with JP in Tremblant. And I broke my collarbone another time, skiing in the pipe. So 3 times in a row, kind of in 1 year. And then it really like JP had quit, Cusson had quit, Dorion had quit. Everybody had quit Muggles. And I was kind of the last one, because I was one of the best at it.
And at this time when they quit, did they quit for an opportunity to do something with Solomon? Right? Because they probably just got a flow pair of skis for the like F9s. And then all of a sudden, why did they quit? Like, did they quit because they got an offer to quit? Or did they quit because they're like, I want to go make movies? Like, what was on the table?
It was tough to quit. Like, for everybody, it was tough to quit because we all loved mogul skiing so much. And we all had dreams of being champion in that sport.
Mogul skiing, or did you just like hitting the jumps?
Me, I like skiing. Like, yeah, I'm a skier. So I like both about it. Like I was pretty good at jumping, and it was my way to stand out. And usually it's the way to stand out for a mogul skier. But me, I was good at skiing. Like I always was a good skier. So I really love skiing muggles and jumping as well. But the thing was that everybody had quit because we felt that we had something to do with that new sport, and we felt that it was our little baby, as we put it oftentimes at that time, and it was our little baby, and we needed to see it grow, and we needed to take care of it.
So you had an outlet, right, when you guys are quitting, to go film with Johnny, to go film with like MSP, right? It's just going on, but like. Before the goal was Olympic dream, right? The gold medal.
Yeah.
Like there's a long process, like peaking, doing all this stuff, going through injury for one day, one gold. And so when giving it up, like all you guys did, give up something you love because you were held back from rules. Did your sponsor, so you had Rosnell as a sponsor in the moguls, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you decide to quit, is there something like some kind of opportunity that's presenting itself at all? Or do you have to just quit and be like, I just got to go do tricks?
For me, it was they were supportive, and they helped me with what I wanted to do, and I can reassure you, they didn't help me that big. So they helped.
Did they want to make a twin tip right away though? Like right? So you're just quitting, so you need this tool. I think Dino Star had the rip stick at this time. Solomon, I saw it in the Patty Graham. You held it up. It's like before the Power. It kind of looks like it, but it's not a real twin tip. So it's like a 160. And same with the rip stick that you guys had. Was there an incentive to be able to create a tool that you needed or wanted at this time? Support?
When you said an incentive, it was like they were asking for it.
Well, I'm just saying you're going to quit something you love, something that you've been dedicated to. And when something that might have been in your decision, I'm guessing if they were like, yo, man, we're going to make a 1080 just like them, or we're going to do this. Were they saying they were going to get into the sport that Johnny D was documenting?
No.
Did they? No?
Yeah, we had to push we had to push, basically, the way it happened at Rossignol, or this is my side of the story, like a lot of people.
That's what I want to hear, because I've heard a lot of Solomon. I've never heard the Rossignol story.
The Rossignol story is that Solomon has their skis. Summer 99, I guess, the 1080.
Yeah.
I think so. Something around that. And me, I have no skis. I'm with my Mogol ski, and I have the rec from Rossignol, but the ski doesn't work that well. And I'm at Rossignol in the office at Rossignol France, and I'm bitching about it, very loud. Everybody can hear me. And there is that guy, what's his name again? Anyway, it was the head of the R&D at that time. And he heard me and he's listening to me. And at one point he took me apart and he's like, yeah, what do you want? And I'm like, yeah, I want this and that. And 3 months later, I have my ski. Because I was lucky enough to bump into that guy, and it's his job, you know. It's his job to do new stuff and to fulfill a athlete's desire. You know, it was just a matter of connecting to each other, because I was not a Rossignol was such a big company that you needed to be at least recognized for something in order to be listened to. And me, I was just bitching in the office. And actually, we did a bunch of other little prototype with him, and it was a great adventure. And it kind of started my desire to design and shape skis. It was Henri Debordes, the head of the R&D. It was such a great time because the guy was listening, and then he was trying to do what I wanted, and it was just awesome. That's how it happened at Rossignol.
So it had to be better within the first year. It had to be better than Mogul's, because I mean, fuck, man. Even if you make World Cup, they're like, we'll give you 50% off two pair, at least as Americans. You know, like as far as getting a pair of hard skis or something.
Yeah, well, me, I was always at Rossignol. They treat me pretty good because my mother was a world champ for Rossignol, and of course I had. You know, I in the ski world, it was never hard for me to get stuff because of my family.
Yeah.
And because Rossignol is from France, you have proximity. Yeah. I never struggled to get skis. I was lucky enough for that. But then, yeah, the energy, even at Rossignol, the Rossignol at that time was the Bandit. It was the Bandit campaign. It was a free ride, and I was part of that little team. So it was a good energy around that. But then it was hard to push it towards the freestyle stuff. At one point, I think the CEO tried a ski and realized it was a ski that was super easy, super fun to ski. And then I think they sold 7,000 pair of the power.
Yeah.
At that time, it was like, all right, we made our money back. We're starting to make some money with that ski. And it was not a problem anymore to have a ski.
Yeah.
And it was more a problem to make the ski how we wanted. Cause you push it, you make it through to the market, and then, they're like, oh, it's ours. We do whatever we want with it. And that's where we made Armada. Because it was like, well, this is not what I want to make with that. I want to control this and that. And Rossignol was wonderful, but it was too big for a small kid like me, like 20 years old, to dictate the way he wanted the ski to look. Like everything, you know.
Well, I'd say so, if you took when you're 19, 20, 21 years old and you look at what Rossignol did with the Power Grind, so you had three generations of Power within the first 2 year and a half, and then you had the scratch before you exited, right?
Yeah.
Which was a whole different design. So what you were able to make a major like corporation do for ski design, lucky you had that meeting. But man, to do that many prototypes with a major company, like that's like some line ski shit. But that was probably all because you poked. Like the innovation that was done in 2.5 years, it's pretty crazy to think about, because you have to remember they still only allowed you to build a 160 and a 180, right?
So yeah, even it was very interesting, and they were Rossignol always had been a little shy, you know. They were always waiting for Salomon to do good stuff and then copy them and put them to the market.
Where's Dina Star in that conversation?
But Dina Star, I think it was a little bit of the same way, but it was, I don't really know about Dina Star.
They're French, man. That's the only reason I ask.
But they made some good skis. Like the first, when you see the first Candide ski was dispute of the design, and Candide was mad about it, like the cow design and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The ski was actually really good. Dina Star has always been doing good skis. Like the construction, the wood, it's always been good. Like I, over the year, like I don't agree with all the shapes, but it's, you know, you can't agree with everybody's way of doing stuff. It's normal. But Dina Star is a very, at least production-wise and quality-wise, I think it's a very good company. But anyhow, what I was saying.
I don't know. Sorry to tangent so much. You have so many answers that I want.
Yeah, you were moving on from the power grind
to the scratch
Armada, because you weren't necessarily getting what you wanted with Rossignol anymore. So tell us about the whole saga that started Armada. That's like a very interesting point that has not been so well documented, and especially on your behalf. And we'd love to know how Armada started in your perspective.
But I think Armada started out of frustration from Salomon and Rossignol on our side. And it's, I
want to know just your view, Julian, because the reason why we brought this question up is because I always wanted to do a documentary where I ask everyone that started Armada how Armada started, not only in their view, because everyone has such a different path on how it began, right? And so I'm most interested on like your view, you know, like who you talked to first, how you assembled. Like, I think that's the most interesting thing we can capture today. Like, I'd love to hear how you started it. You know what I mean? Because I think everyone individually started it and then brought people together. So how did you start Armada, Julian?
I think it's out of the scratch project. I was not happy with the name. Very happy with the shape. Very happy with the ski. Not happy with the name. Not happy with the communication around it. And wanted to do something a little bit more core and do something with a team. I always wanted to ski with JP initially, and of course Cusson, and then we gather a team. But the initial starting point is my frustration from my current sponsor, and of course the first person I've talked to is JP, because we were always talking together at that time, regarding trips, regarding tricks, regarding the sports, and it was the first person I talked to, and then we start talking, and then we start gathering people and trying to make the project together.
And because something I want to make it clear right here on this point with you and JP. Like, you and JP are the original creators of the first prototype from ground zero, before money was involved, before some management was involved, and all of this. So I want to make sure you get your flowers there, because what you and JP did, not only to lead the charge, but then to put your own money in the prototypes and stuff, and to build them out of Quebec with your knowledge of, like, ski building and all this. I just, everyone needs to know. Like you were a big part in even making sure there was a physical product that was good. So thanks for that, man.
We did that first proto. I think JP paid for it. Pretty sure JP paid for it.
Yep.
And I designed it. We're talking to the factory, putting some dimension out. We did the first proto. I was skiing in Whistler with the first proto. I was still skiing for Rossignol, and I cross a French rider named Mathieu Imbert on the park, and I was like, oh shit, I got the prototype. Like, he was riding for Rossignol at that time, I think, and I had to tell him, like, you haven't seen me with those skis, like, I'm not skiing those skis. Like, I was super scared. Because of course, at that time, we didn't know if the project was gonna
There's no financial funding.
Yeah,
it was just passion.
So
something else I want to tell everyone: Julian was 20 years old at the time, 21, and JP was like 21 or 22. So to me, I always think this is the sickest part, because I always try to take the hottest 21-year-old in the industry every year and be like, would they ever quit their money and go start a company? So, like, even for the last 20 years, for what you guys did to actually take something that was guaranteed with a company that you might not agree with and start something, it was pretty wicked. So, big up yourself on that.
The big influence was the Forum team at that time. Mm-hmm. Those guys were doing – it was so cool that what they were doing. And me, I wanted to be in that state of mind. I wanted to be in a team that would change the industry, that would, you know, I just wanted to be in a place where we were changing the industry. And yeah, 21, thinking about it, that was kind of crazy, but it was the time, like, everything was not crazy, but everything was new. And
everything seemed realistic. Like, you and your friends dreamed up new tricks that no one ever did every day. So if you were landing on your feet and not on your head, why couldn't you do that in a business too, right?
Yeah, well, everybody that I talked to advised me against.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when people advise me against something, I usually do it. So.
Yeah. So here's my next question. When you designed that first ski, so coming from Rossignol, a big thing was, because we were like, man, we like that slanted sidewall or whatever, right? That the scraps changed over from the cap. Was there any repercussion from your side in France and, like, stuff like this, where they're like, oh my gosh, Julian stole designs from what people love that we made? Because I remember that was kind of like a saying at the beginning. People are like, oh, they stole a scratch design or something. Did you have to deal with anything on your end with that?
No. I think we had a good conversation with David Bouvier at that time. I just left the company. And it was the end of my contract. And that was it. Nothing crazy that I remember.
Phil, we're at an hour. I just super fanned out up until the start of Armada. Phil's 13 years old. Take it over, my friend.
Hell yeah. So what I'm interested in is, when does the JJ Elf shoe shape take shape in your mind? Like, how does that design come into play? Because that, I guess, like, that's jumping forward quite a bit from the start of Armada, but that's something very notable that you did, like, huge among skiing that changed the whole course of things. And that's something that really interested me, is how did that idea sprout in your mind?
Okay, I'll try to be fast. I've always been kind of slow in the progression of skiing, and I think it's still true, and I explain you why. Because you imagine you feel skiing the ski you ski right now, like 10 years ago, I don't think you'd be able to do it. It has to progress at the same speed as the style the boots, the everything, you know, like you can't just like leap into the future and think that the athletes are going to be better just because of a perf ski. So I've always been like kind of conservative with my ski design, knowing that it needs to fit the athletes, the energy, and what we can do. So I've never been a wow of ski design, but just I think I've been able to fit really well to the sports. And we start slowly with the regular JJ, which was a ski that was wide with a straight straight side cut and pretty soft tip and tail, very long. But it you know, the soft tip and tail and the straight side cut is something that had slightly changed the way that the skis were designed at that time. And then I skied that ski for 3 years, and then I jump on the machete from Volant and from what's his name? I can't believe I forget.
McConkey.
Shane McConkey, of course. I bought that ski and I skied on an elite trip. I skied in the powder. Just on one run in Switzerland, and I put myself on that ski. And I was like, "Wow, this is just like insane what you can do with it." As far as pivot, as far as control over bad snow, it was a all new way of skiing and something that I grasped really fast, and it got me thinking. Well, first off, like the year prior to that, I remember reading a powder article about that ski, and they described that ski, and I was like, how the hell is it possible? Like, I wouldn't understand. Like, I was like, is this a joke? And then I get to try the ski, and I was like, okay, it actually works. And from that, I was like, okay, I just need the capacity of that McConkey ski with more stability into the in-run, because what I want is to go fast into in-runs. And I want a little bit more stability on the hard pack. So we designed the ARG with a small base, flat base, and with a long rocker. And it was exceptional year in Whistler. The ski enabled us to do a lot of different things, but it was not stable enough. It was lacking of some capacity for freestyle, and especially when the snow was getting harder. But it was extremely interesting. So I think I skied that ski for one or two seasons pretty hard. And then it was time to redesign the JJ. And I decided to take a step further with the JJ. So less more side cut, a little bit thinner on the foot, more base, like skiing base. And then that ski came out. And I was right out of the bat, I was not really happy with the flex. And I was not able to change the flex because it's an industrial constraint that I was slowly learning, and it's tough when you're a young kid. It's all about constraint, like in to make skis, and we're doing that ski with at the Atomic Factory, and at the Atomic Factory, when you decide on flex, pretty much if it's not correct, you have to recut a mold and correct it from there. And I don't think we had enough money to recut the mold. So I went with that flex for a couple of years. And that flex was really tough underfoot and a little bit progressive on the tip and tail. But more than the progression of the flex, it was because of the rocker that you would feel a flex. Because you can have a 100% a stiff ski, but if you have a lot of rocker, then of course you're gonna feel... It's not the ski flexing, but you're getting unbalanced, and it's the same effect in a sense. Yeah. Like instead of pushing on the ski, you just rock on the ski. and you kind of have the same effect. You know, you probably don't get the bounce back the same way, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, I didn't like the fact that ski was so rough and tough. And then I went to Black Rose and I designed the Nocta, and the Nocta flex pattern was way better. So with a smoother flex pattern, you really feel the ski arcing under your foot, and it's a way more better skier experience than.
You never perfected what you wanted with JP Virgilium, and then like you figured out now that you got to work with Black Rose and how you design now.
Yeah. I think the best the best JJ was the Nocta for me. But anyway, it's always you know, as I say, you.
No, but it's interesting what you can and can't learn, you know, because obviously I love watching your passion for ski design, because I'd watch Pollard, right? He made so many cardboard. His whole house was just cardboard cutouts with rises and flexes. Like, he was on a weird thing. So it's kind of fun to listen to you, because it's brilliant shit. It's like talking to a scientist right now. Like, I'm just like, I kind of get it, but I get that you're passionate, you know, and this is why an athlete matters, I think. You know, this goes back to the whole overall thing. You know, like, this is why you're so important to this whole industry, and should be important for people knowing who you are, is because it's taken you 20 years to design the illest shit ever. That's why you have to be around. That's why you have to be known who you are, and everyone has to know it takes a long time to get better. So
yeah, and it's always about sticking to the practice and understanding the practice. Like, I'm not a big listener. Like, I'll listen a few people. Like, people always want you to tell you what they love into the skis. You know, they're like, hey, you should do that. I'm like, who the fuck are you? I need to understand how the guy ski, I need to trust him, and I need to respect him in order to listen to the skiers, because everybody has his opinion in about skiing. And I mess up a lot of a ski design by listening too much. To me, it's a lot about what I feel and how I see the practice of the ski.
Yeah.
And it's something that it's very particular to translate an idea of a ski design and a practice, you know, and the move you will do on the ski, and how you will move on the ski. Like, feel, like, I'd be really interested to talk with Phil, actually, because I think the way he moves on the ski is very different from what I can do. And therefore, I'll need a tool that's particular to his practice. And some people are able to just translate it into a drawing, and some people can't. Very good skier, a lot of very good skier just can't do that. And it's interesting, because it's something that's only a few people in the industry are able to do. Like, Eric Pollard is a good example, because he's a very extremely good ski designer. And then you have the designer that are more coming from a scientific side. You know, they know how to use the CAD application, CAD design stuff. And oftentimes in the big company, I have the feeling that they are missing a link with skiing, like the ability to have a skier really translate into a shape.
I think it's like what you said about Phil. Like, I mean, the most that can be done for him without him having the knowledge like you do is someone take the edges off the product, right? Or like, say, put some carbon fiber stringers to say you can ollie bigger. But if you had someone like you who's listening, you're like, wait a second, if your nose buttering into that and I torsion the nose a little bit, and then you can actually grab while you're, you know what I mean? Like, there's no level of production going into his product, because his product is just a warranty issue. So it's pretty fun to think about the sky being the limit for ski design, if you care and if you love it and if you have the ability to do it.
Yeah. But it's the constraint as well that we have in our industry is that the ski that we put out for the athlete oftentimes are the skis that that you can buy in the shop. So it's and I also think it's about the success of a brand. It's to be able to have that mix of good skis and also skis that clients are gonna enjoy. And of course, clients are always good skiers. You know how it is. But really, you have to tone down a little bit. I toned down a lot of my design because if I would do it for only for the top athletes, it's going to be tough to ski.
Yeah, makes sense. What do you got, Phil?
Yeah,
Jonas and I are longest, but I could go for another 10 hours, man. Like, there's so many cool things with Julia.
Man, I mean, we got so much to learn and covered so little in such a long span of time, but I was curious, Julian, as a skier, and I want to highlight skier here because your contribution is like far beyond only skiing with, as we were speaking of right now, ski design. But as the skier, Julian Renier, like what's been overlooked in your career? You feel you didn't get credit for whether it be a certain trick or style, you know,
like double pants.
No. We had that little controversy about the D-spin, which was all fun. And of course, I'm a very good friend of Mike Douglas, and there is no sweat about it. Of course, Paddy Graham was the instigator of all that, and was trying to play on the words. I don't know. My career is my career. Like I think I could have done better, but I think it probably was my work ethic and the way I am that's all. It's only my fault. If I was not better, but I had a great career regardless. Many years of good project. I don't even remember the name of the movies. But I have a few good segments.
And I was the movies you made because Julian was also a filmmaker, and the Up One movies were epic. You used to edit your segments with JP for propaganda and stuff. I remember because I was down there. So that's something we didn't even talk about on what you brought. Like, you were one of the first fucking underground ski movies that were weird and epic.
We did a lot of projects in skiing and I don't know, man. Like, fame and what's hot and what's not in skiing, it's hard to understand. Like, I know that I was always trying to push the backcountry side because I had back problems and the park, me, I was not interested into the park. And my big thing was the backcountry. I've pushed ski design wise. I've made my host is gone. Well, how can I?
I'm still here, man. Like, I want to hear the Julian story. He's listening.
I'm listening. I just got a charge for those of you.
No worries. One thing I was proud of is it's also the Red Bull Line Catcher. It's a competition that I made with Red Bull France. And it was such an epic event when condition were right. I was all the friends gathering for a backcountry competition
on real mountains
in crazy places. But it's one thing that I'm very proud of, the Red Bull Line Catcher, because I think it really showcased the backcountry freestyle scene the way it deserves to be. And when you see the Freeride World Tour now, when you see what kids are doing now, I think it was a leap in the future 10 years ago.
Because the first year you did that? Like, because CR and Candide and Sean Pettit were on a podium 1 year. Was that the very first year?
No, it was the second or the third. Okay. Maybe the
third. You started that in like 2007 then, huh?
I think so.
Wicked.
Yeah. To answer your question, Phil, I don't think I deserve anything more than I got, and I've got a lot from that sport. Like I'm still designing skis. I'm still having fun with Black Rose, and I'm designing all the skis at Black Rose. I'm still living off skiing, making videos, making pictures every day. And the ski industry has paid me back 1,000 times. And it, you know, how the ski industry is, it pays a little. So 1,000 times, it's just that small. It's all good.
Yeah, way to stay humble, because definitely by all that you've done, I feel like you're not so celebrated, but it doesn't matter, as you say. But that's part of your humble character. I wanted to make sure you had like a platform to say like whatever you thought your shit was hot, then it deserved to be known, and we knew it was. That's why you on. And jumping on and a subject we just touched upon, and you were involved in editing, like how did that come about, you getting involved in editing? Is it with UP1 first movies, or when did that all start?
We got involved with editing with Johnny, and it was the first year travel in the summer at Johnny's place. It was in East Hollywood or something like that, like in the valley in Los Angeles.
Riverside,
maybe, yeah. And I was with Cusson. It was so messy. I think we were editing out of Final Cut Pro on an 8-bit timeline, which I didn't understand why my reds were all pixelated. So the movie was edited like the wrong way altogether, technically wise. But it was super funny. Like Johnny had that deck to be able to ingest the footage, which was on tape, and we're supposed to get it out with the SDI wire, and Johnny was like, ah, fuck that, it's too complicated, let's get it out of the mini DV ingesting platform, which was crap for the final output, because it was super amateur. And he decided to drop the whole setup that the pro guy was telling him to do. And anyway, I got like, I'm pretty nerdy person. Like I like to understand the things that I touch. So I got into editing, and we were helping at the first thing. We were helping Johnny editing, you know, trying to select our tricks, trying to put it together. You know, that was a big thing at that time. Like the tricks would be cut like one angle, then the next, one angle, then the next. And I hated it because you wouldn't understand the flow of the tricks. And I was like telling to Johnny, like, you gotta start with one angle and rewind back and let the brain reset for understanding the whole move, you know? Like at that time, like the editing style was like one angle, and then you would pick up at the same time, and my brain wouldn't understand the move, you know, because you change angle. So anyway, it was just like that, this kind of style that we were trying to put into the editing, and I think it was which one was that? The Degenerate? Not the game? No, not the game. What was
13 it? 13 was after it. 13 was the Summer of the Whistler Open.
Okay. but I think it was might have been Degenerate. I don't remember. No, it was Degenerate for it was the 99, summer 99, for sure.
Right there.
But anyway, that's how I got into editing, and then we kept with JP and a bunch of other athletes. We kept coming back for editing our segment, and Johnny was pretty happy about it because you know it was a better selection of tricks. You see how flat those landings were. Better selection of tricks, and it was the way that we would do it these years.
Were you at the premiere of 13?
No. I was never at premiere of anything because I was back in Europe.
Okay.
So wow. I missed pretty much all the premiere of all the movies.
That was special. Like first time on an airplane, California. There was an earthquake. Vinny thought there was fucking a fight in the hotel, but it was the earthquake. It was great. Okay.
Yeah, those guys were always being paid by Salomon to go do all those things, and I was on my budget, man. So I was not coming.
Fuck. Weren't you an Oakley guy though?
I was Oakley, but I think Oakley didn't care that much for the premiere and stuff. They had enough people.
It's true. They did have enough people.
Here's Julian's segment from Session 1242, the famous Oakley movie that changed the game. And we're about to see here pretty soon Nose Butters 3 in the pipe. This shot is heat, too. But here, the Nose Butter 3, I think, is the first one I saw of its kind. Maybe you can talk about that, how that shot right here. Booyah!
Yeah, that's like a Phil Inspiration 15 years prior.
Yeah. You want to see it again?
No. But I know about it. I had a rough year that year because I broke my pinky. It went into the wheel of my snowmobile, and it really shattered the whole pinky. Like it was 90 degree. It was just bad. So anyway, I couldn't film for like 2 months during the winter. And as I said, like I didn't feel it was important, that movie. I didn't get it, you know. Sometimes you're in the zone and you know you have to do something and you know you have to work for it. And in those years, like I think I lost myself. I lost my focus, and I didn't know. It was pretty tough because I was on I think it was the first year of Armada, and the support from Armada was like kind of weird at the beginning, at the end as well. We were on our own, absolutely on our own. Coming from French team, you have a staff, you have people taking care of you, training, blah blah, and then you're jumping into that part of the industry where basically you're your own coach, your own manager, and you gotta set your own focus and your own goals. I should have had somebody to kick my ass and say, Julian, you gotta work for that shit. Which I did a little bit after, I think, and a little bit before. But some years I didn't have it. And it was probably one of those years with 1242 because with the injury, and it took most of the season out. It's just a pinky, but I had a metal pin into my thumb, into my pinky. I just couldn't write. It was just not possible. And then I went to a summer camp this summer to try to film more. For that movie, because I had only a few footage, I decided to do that Nose Butter stuff. I didn't think it was that exceptional, but regardless,
But now, 20 years later, you're still getting props for it. So it was nice. Exceptional.
Well, anyway, like that was the year. What we all remember, it was a Pep segment in that movie because it was fantastic. It pushed the boundary of skiing switch into the powder and jumping. Like it was really strong. So that's probably what's remembered from that movie.
Would you say that's the biggest individual segment ever in Twin Tip, like the first 10 years? Can you think of any other segment where people were just like, what the fuck, at that level? I can't. Fives both ways, and then the 180 on a cliff. It's crazy.
No, yeah, it was. But to me, that I was still, like, I'm still amazed with Cusson capacity and Cusson gymnastic. I think I'm still more impressed with Cusson because Cusson was like pushing doors all the time, and just like, you know, he had that I don't know, he said in English, but you know, he didn't care. He's like, yeah.
That's exactly how you'd say it.
She's going to do it. And he was doing it. And for me, Cusson was really the genius of the sports at the beginning. Hands down, like, GF Cusson was like the shit. So to me, my light of the sports and my first thing is GF Cusson. And then Pep Foujas, it's, you know, it's a kid to me.
When Pep happens,
it's not the beginning.
So Pep happens. It's your first year of Armada. You're kind of on your own. Do you compare yourself to him? Because he just kind of went ahead of the sport so much, and he came out of nowhere. Realistically, he was on vocals at a Oakley Super Park shoot like the spring before, right? Like other than that, he was on vocals a year and a half previous. And so, like, what's your thought as like a guy who's like a foundation member of the sport? You like just started the illest ski company on the world, and then booyah, fuha.
I guess I was in a different zone. Like I always try to do my stuff, and I was not trying to compare myself with other people and other athletes, which I think was a mistake, really, because I think I lost a little bit of my competitiveness and my competitive sense. And I was like, I just wanted to do my stuff. And in order to perform really well in that sport, you still need to be comparing yourself to other guys. But maybe it was a way to protect myself and to just be in my zone. But really, I think it was a mistake. But anyway, in protecting myself, I was trying to push stuff a different way, which also create a good things, you know, because I know I was not probably not as talented as Pep, so I needed to do things differently. So it's also a way to bring a different flavor to a sports. So I did my best. But
I just want to say, like, I don't think you like should have done it any other way, because the fact that you're still around and like it's not being lazy, because you're always trying to invent, and when you're trying to invent and create your own lane, it's like sometimes you're not creating, but you're at least looking for how to go forward, you know? So like,
and it's, right, it takes now, a lot,
huh?
It takes a lot of energy to do that.
Yeah,
like it takes a lot of energy to just not go in the park and do the same trick over and over. And it takes a lot of energy to do that. Like, but okay, JP told me that once that that we were always going into the backcountry. I was in Whistler, and we were every day that we could, we'd take our sled, go to the backcountry, build a new jump, and it was tough to do new tricks on it because we always had a new jump. We always had to work for sometimes days to build a jump.
Yeah.
And but we were always trying to do new stuff. And so we lacked a little bit of repetitiveness to be on the trick side,
yeah,
to be on the top.
But if you look at the artist side of you, and we look at all the features you guys built in Whistler those years, like whether it was the hips, step up, step downs, like every feature was unique. And that's where you guys, like you and JP, kind of put you in, that's why you guys are ski together. You both like viewed it more as like being an artist. Like it's not just the trick off a cheese wedge. You're like, oh, yes, man, like the visual mattered. You know, because you're creating who you're, the essence of who you guys were through the format of movie. And like, that was the big thing. Like, you love moguls and you love skiing, but you understood once you compete in it, someone's going to tell you if you're good or bad. And so, like, the film era allowed you as an artist and a creator and someone went out and did dope shit. Like, dude, everything you guys put together, whether it was the segment for like a major production company, making your own film, or like even the individual shots for your cameraman. Hey, Tyler, go stand over there. We're going to get one cameraman, John. Like, you guys figured out shit so early where it's like, I don't know, and that's where you have to understand, because I've heard you say it now a couple times. You're like, oh, man, I wish I would have done this or that different. I would say don't do anything different. It's just people don't know what you did, because the amount of work you have to go through and then the sacrifices to go from a Rosinal to an Armada, zero support. Oh, yeah, I got a salary. Oh, why didn't it? Checks in the mail. 3 years, you know, like no financial support there, or the idea like, hey, we're going to set up a shoot for you. You know, like we got it all paid. Like there's so many elements that were eliminated by creation. Like, yo, you, I just want to say fucking everything you did was right for how you did it. And you're still here. We won the lottery.
Thank you. No, but of course it's, I think I can be proud of what was achieved in the ski industry for sure, and also Armada is something that I'm proud of, but really really mad about it at the same time. I have two.
And I'd love to do a whole hour show on that one with you one day.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time to. Sorry. No more batteries into my stuff.
Yeah, I think no,
Armada is surely can you guys hear me?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, no, Armada is a big part I don't think I'm in here. Jesus. Anyway. But also Black Rose is something that I'm very proud of, because we've been able to achieve with that brand something that's unique and really represent the whole ski world. As when I built Armada, I was really core and really freestyle based, and then you grew up and you realize that, well, alpine skiing is cool too, you know.
Yeah.
And skiing is just a community, and it's just something that has to do with nature, mountains, and people, and more than just a category of guy in a park grabbing their skis. And it's what I saw with Black Rose. I saw the opportunity to talk to more skiers and to talk about skiing as a whole family and as a way of life, and through the ski design and through the brand and the communication, it's been a wonderful journey, and it still is, and it's something that I'm proud of, because I think with Black Rose we have brought something to the ski industry.
Yeah, have you been with them since day one, or how did I? How what's your role with Black Rose? Are you a founder?
I'm not a founder. Camille Jacou, Bruno Compagnier, and Christophe Villemain are the three founders. I came in 3 years into the project, 2 years I think. And since then I've been working on marketing, of course ski design. I'm doing all the skis. and marketing and just putting the brand into the map. I can't really tell you all the things that I've done with the brand, and now I can show you guys that it's where I'm working now. It's my little office, and I have a photo and video studio, and it's just a white room. I just bought a robot, and it's not working. I think I broke it today.
Oh man, it looks like an expensive thing to break.
Yeah.
Good luck fixing that guy.
This is where we're doing all our shoot at Black Rose.
Where are you guys located?
Me, I'm located right next to La Plagne, in the valley. And yeah. Oh, I also have tools.
Are you, do you still live in this house right by the bobsled?
Yeah, nice. Still there. But yeah, this is what we are able to do with Black Hole. It's nice as well. Anyway, I don't know if you have any more questions. It's been a long time.
It is a long time.
Getting sleepy, I think.
Oh no, dude, it's all new people. The cycle that comes in and out, attention spans are small. We just want an hour and a half. So that means people average around 10. There's only a couple super core fans here, like Turpin, and like say whatever. But the rest, we get for about 10, 15 minutes. Realistically, we probably cycled almost 2,000 people through this bit.
Nice.
Yeah, man. They know who Julien Renier is.
That's right. Well, deservingly, thank you so much for coming on with us today, Julien, and also on the behalf of Skiing and everybody on here on the platform, thank you so much for being a pillar to the sport and making so many great things from just tricks themselves to skis to new technology that influence a whole generation to shape a new style and form of shredding on snow. So thank you, bud.
I think Brad Holmes just said he's been here the whole time. Is that really you, Brad Holmes? You got so many super fans. If Brad Holmes is here, man, I just made my day.
Sick.
Because he's cocky as hell. You want to talk shit, he'll ring your bell.
He's the nicest guy on the planet.
Well, I was just doing his rap song from that ski movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Julien, so much, man.
Always good to see you riding, and you're a very good influence on the sports as well. That's for sure.
Thank you, brother.
Thanks, Eric.
Yeah, man. Great to see your face, Julien.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Yes, sir. Take care. Hope to see you.
Ciao, man. We got Mikko next week.
Nice.
So,
cool. Yeah, stick.
We'll keep it year old for a while to make sure we educate him on the forgotten motherland.
Yeah. Say hi for me. Maybe I try to log on for sure.
Yeah, please.
Cool.
Awesome. Take care, guys. Have a wonderful day.
Cheers.
Peace, y'all. Thank you for connecting with us, everybody that stayed along on this conversation. We're going to be giving flowers to Mikhail Dishno, none other than Douche Dog, Snoop Kale, the one and only. Next week, 13:31 is the time, East Coast. That makes it April 13, I believe. So thanks for tuning in. Shout out to y'all. Much love. Peace.